Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
I'm Nikki, I'm a drunk.
Hey.
Am I going through back there?
Okay.
So apparently I'm the fluffer. I'm going to warm y'all up. And then Jenny's going to give the real sobriety talk, okay? So,
Nice.
Yeah, classy too. So I'm a shit the bed drunk. I was talking to somebody the other day, one of my really good friends that's known me for close to 20 years, I guess it was 2 days ago, and we were talking, and I forget how the subject came up, and I said, oh, well, you know, I used to ride my motorcycle drunk until I blacked out. And she goes, what? Like, this was, she said, why did you do that? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. What do you mean, why did I do that? I get all sorts of shit drunk, you know? I should have killed myself. She goes, you should have been dead. And I said, that's not the only time I should have been dead. And so I kind of went into the story just about how, you know, I was riding a motorcycle. I woke up. There was a tree about where Michael is. The road ended here. My front wheel was off the road. I was doing about 40 miles an hour. And the next thing I knew, I woke up in bed the next morning with a massive, hangover. And I did the body check, and I was living with my girlfriend, and she goes, what's the matter? I said, I'll be right back. And, like, I had raging headaches when I had those things. So I jumped out of bed. I ran into the garage, and I looked, and I saw my beat-to-shit Italian motorcycle sitting in the garage where it always fucking was, not an extra scratch on it. And I came back in and had some coffee, and she goes, what's the matter? I said, oh, nothing. You know, and I was like, I wasn't telling her that I had, when I woke up, the last thing I remembered was that tree the night before. And you know, it's like I've made lots of decisions drinking, like really good decisions. But I didn't remember this decision until I got sober. But what I decided was, you know, that motorcycle has a bunch of electrical problems. I don't think I'm going to ride it anymore. That's the justification I told myself for not riding that bike ever again. And it was 2-3 years later, I got sober. 7-8 years later, I decided that I had a bunch of motorcycle buddies that were sober, and I was like, isn't it like crazy to ride? And I said, no, it's a gift of sobriety. You know, you ought to get out and ride. So I started riding. I go to a motorcycle rally a month later. And I'm 8 or 9 years sober, and I go to this rally. Oh, and my motorcycle had broken down. It was a German one. And I'm sober, and I've got lots of time. I've done the steps. I'm going to meetings all the fucking time, all that kind of happy horse shit. And I walk into this motorcycle rally, and I'm about to drink. And I am fucking scared as shit. And I don't, you know, I'm like, just like quivering. And I say, I got to fucking leave. And I'd driven. So I was a pussy because, pardon me, I was a numbnut because I had driven to a motorcycle rally. And I just had complete shame about it. And I get ready to leave, and I'm walking out, and I got enough time. I thought about drinking maybe 8 or 10 times during that whole time I was sober, and I wanted a fucking drink. And I was like shaking with fear that I was going to drink or get struck drunk. And I walk out the it was an outdoor thingy, and there was a sign on a post that said, you know, they had the circle and the triangle. It said, friend of Bill W's, meet here at 5:30. It was 5:15, and it was right there. It was that close. And I walked in, and I sat down, and I started fucking crying. And everybody's like, you okay, man? And I said, I don't know. And the whole meeting was about learning to ride sober, because all of these people had, you know, ridden drunk, had done drugs, had done every fucking thing that people who like to party like we like to party do. And they had learned to live and ride sober from the beginning of their sobriety, because they were continuing to ride, and I had this gap because I had stopped. And at that meeting, I realized that I had stopped riding because riding motorcycles was getting in the way of my drinking. So I continued to drive drunk, but I wouldn't ride a motorcycle drunk. And, you know, it's like, and what these people said, they said, you don't know how to live. I mean, you know how to live sober in 9/10 of your life, but you don't know how to ride sober. So it makes sense that you'd feel like a newcomer. It makes sense that you'd want to fucking drink. And so I didn't tell my friend that story. I just told her the part about, you know, blacking out. And so clearly I didn't tell you the shit the bed story. I just told you the blackout riding motorcycle story, but you might get a chance to see that I might have a problem with alcohol. And I had a problem with, I did not have control over my drinking from the beginning. I drank to get drunk. I drank to get fucked up. I did not drink because I wanted to be a fucking gentleman. You know, that was never on my list of things to do. I've learned to live. I guess one of the things they used to say to me all the time that I had to remember when this thing happened, and I sometimes have to remember today, is every new thing I do in sobriety, everything I do in sobriety that I haven't done before is brand new to me, because as a sober human being, I've never been able to do that without drinking. And so I have to learn all kinds of shit with, you know, how to live that way without drinking. And that's why every day that I wake up, I'm essentially newly sober, because all I got is today, and I don't know how to live today sober without the help of others like you guys, and, you know, this using and doing the steps and applying the principles of living sober in my life. Thanks.
I'm Jenny. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jenny.
It's nerve-wracking to be here, but I'm really grateful to be here. I'm one of those people that never thought you would say, you know, I could say I'm a grateful alcoholic. I thought that was the most horrible thing to say when I first came here. I'm like, what do you fucking be grateful for? I don't want to be here. But the truth of the matter is, like, I live a life today beyond my wildest dreams. I never thought that I could have the life that I have, and I owe it all to AA, like every step of the way. And, well, you know, many of you here have known me a long time and have, you know, since like day one or day minus 10, actually. And, you know, I've come a long way. And it's a fucking long time to speak, but I will just stick to the format and just share with you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I was born in Canada, and my parents moved to the States when I was like maybe 2 or 3 or something like that, but I'm still actually Canadian, which is crazy. But we came here, and my parents are both like super workaholics, and growing up right out of the gate, I was always like someone who was different, who didn't fit in, who didn't know how to like make friends, and like, you know, I was just always weird. And my parents were both, they would just leave me places for like months at a time with strangers, and I didn't know who these people were, and they would come sometimes like maybe once a week and like take me out for dinner and then drop me back off. And like that was like my childhood and like how I remembered. And I just remember, and this is like kind of a part of my story in a sense, like I feel like we're shaped a lot by like how we were raised by our parents. And I know that for me, I experienced a lot of neglect, a lot of emotional abuse, and a lot of abandonment. And from the get-go, what happened was like my parents would leave me there, and each time I'd be like, no, don't leave me, no, don't leave me. And then they'd drop me back off, and then they'd be gone, and then the next week would roll around, and then they'd do the same thing. And so I think innately I always like felt like there was just something really wrong with me, because like why else would they leave me here? And so from an early age, like I would always try to like escape into anything. And I was like, I'm an addict to the core, you know, like anything that you put in front of me that changes how I feel, I want more of it now all the time and forever until it kills me, basically. I just can't get enough. And anything like whether it was like video games, it was like a gallon of ice cream or cookies or whatever, like early on, like, you know, I was just like this, like people were just like, I was like a really, really skinny kid, and like when I would ever be at the table, I would eat like 3 pizzas and like a whole like 3 liters of Coke, and people would be like, are you okay? Like, I'd eat like sticks of butter, and like, it's not like my parents starved me, because that's just, I was just hungry. I was just hungry for like love, like something to fill that hole that was already inside of me, you know, that was like, that I was desperate to like make whole. And, I remember we moved around a lot, and, you know, like, I just remember having lots of different friends all over the place, and I remember by about the age of 10, my dad had taken off, and it was a whole other sideline story, but he ended up marrying my mother's brother's ex-wife or whatever. And so anyway, so there's a whole drama over there, and I don't have a relationship with anymore because that's a whole crazy thing. But in any case, I grew up with my mom, and my mom is a functioning alcoholic to this day. And she was kind of a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, and she was either like really like, I love you so much, or like, I hate you, I wish you'd never been born type of thing. And so it was always just like, I never really knew what it was going to be like with her. And I remember by about the age of 10, like, I just had this thought, like, there's something really wrong with me. You know, for the longest time, it was always something's wrong with the world. Like, I don't know why I don't fit in here or what's going on. But by that point, I figured that there's something really fundamentally wrong with me, and I don't know what it is, and I don't want to be here. And my first real addiction was the Beatles, actually. I fucking love the Beatles so much that I would listen to, I had like a Walkman or whatever at that time that would, you know how it would like switch back and forth or whatever, like nonstop. So I would just listen to this like tape, like nonstop until it broke or whatever. And then I'd go buy another one, keep listening to it. And I would listen to it at full blast because that was the only way I just knew how to function. And I would just be in school and on the bus and on the train or whatever, just like listening to the Beatles, and I would read every single book about them that there was, and I'd, like, learn how to sign their autographs like them and talk like them and dress like them. Like, I wanted to be the Beatles, you know? And this is a girl in, like, the, like, late 80s, 90s, you know what I mean? Like, wanting to be the Beatles, you know? And, like, that was how I knew to function in these weird ways, you know? And I kind of used the Beatles until it was, like, you know, over. And I had my first drink with my mom, actually. There's a whole series of like moving all over the place and being everywhere. And by this point, she'd been deemed kind of unfit to be like a parent to me. She would like leave me. She had an apartment in Foster City, and she just like let me live there for like, she would come by once a week with like $20 for groceries, and that was it, you know? And then I was just there, and I would cry myself to sleep every night and pray that God would kill me. Like, I was just so lonely and so desperate. And when I had that first drink with my mom, it was just like magical, because like all I ever did was just think about how shitty the world was and how shitty I must be, and this is never going to end, and it just goes on like this, and other people have it all figured out and I never will. And all of a sudden it just like shut up. Like, it was just quiet, you know? And I remember getting really drunk with my mom, and she had like all these liquor bottles in the freezer or whatever, and we just like made like pint sized glasses of everything and just got sloshed. And we were walking around, like, she lived in this like shitty like one bedroom hotel apartment in like the city or whatever, and we just like walked around like totally drunk, and like all these guys are talking to us, and I just remember I was like 14 just being like, I can't believe this is happening, it's amazing. And like, it was like the first time I like could look at people in the eyes, and it was just like, I felt like, wow, why didn't I do this before? Like, this is awesome, you know? And that was a feeling I chased. And what, you know, kind of my progression of drinking actually didn't last that long, because it just went downhill so fucking fast. And from that day, like, I was living here in Oakland with my dad's family or whatever, going to high school out here. And quickly from being like, you know, straight A, kind of whatever, good student, I was like chain smoking in the parking lot and like selling dope at school and like ditching class. And I would like run to the city and hang out with like these dudes who were like twice my age who would get me high. And it was just like, it was like the only way I knew how to get attention too, right? Like, so I was getting attention from all these dudes. I'm like 15, right? And like these dudes are like 40 or whatever, like buying me booze and like trying to like sleep with me. And I thought that was love, you know? Like, I thought that meant that I'd arrive and that meant something and that maybe I was okay. Like, if they could like me and they would buy me booze, and there's obviously something okay with me. And so I just chased, and I continued to chase, and like things continued to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And I was able to graduate my sophomore year, but barely. And I just remember from there, I was like working in these coffee shops and like just sleeping with fucking guys that were coming in and just like really out of control behavior and just getting high and like thinking to myself, I'm not going to get high tomorrow. And then I'd be higher like 5 minutes later. And it was just, it never occurred to me that I had a problem with drugs and alcohol. I just thought I was depressed and I was crazy and I had a really bad upbringing and all this shit or whatever. And you don't understand me. But it just continued to get worse. And like the feelings inside, like that darkness and that dread and that just like terror when I'd wake up in the morning, like, I fucking have to do this again. And I remember I got to a point where I was like, things were just getting really bad. I was feeling really dark, and I was like, I'm stopping. That is it. no more booze, no more drugs. I'm, like, done smoking weed. I'm, like, going to commit myself to school and, like, get my life together. And I was high, like, 5 minutes later. Like, I just, it was crazy. Like, I couldn't quite understand it. And I was just like, well, I'm just crazy or whatever. And, like, I just kept sinking lower and lower. And I would go to school with, like, I'd be cutting myself. So I'd come up with blood all over myself and, like, obviously cry for help or whatever. And a really nice friend in school was like, hey, dude, there's this, like, Alateen meeting. Let's, like, ditch class and go or whatever. And she was totally, like, trying to, like, get me help, right? But I was just like, oh, that's okay. I'm weird. All right. Yeah, sure. And so we went, and, like, there was all these, like, school counselors that were running the meeting, and they were just like, they saw me and they heard me talk, because all these, like, there's, like, these little girls, like, sharing about how their dads were drinking or whatever. And I was like, I'm your dad. Like, this is really weird. And, they, you know, after they kind of heard my story and they're like, you're really fucked up and you're, like, trying to kill yourself all the time. We're 5150ing you. And I was sent to my first psych hospital. I think I was 15. 16 or something like that, and I went to the Berkeley Herrick Hospital, and, like, I was just nuts and insane, and just, but that was the first time I'd heard about AA, and, like, a bunch of people who do H&I, which is actually, like, a commitment thing that I do now, which I find really important work. They came in, and they brought literature, and they brought their stories, and, you know, like, you know, their messages, and I thought it was really great for them that they were doing all that or whatever, but, you know, whatever. It's, I'm crazy, I'm Chinese, I'm a girl, and all this stuff, like, you don't understand me. And in any case, but it planted the seed, you know, at some level. And I ended up bouncing in and out of mental hospitals for a good while. I ended up getting kicked out of that fancy high school that I went to and out of another one. And then pretty soon my grand uncle's family here in Oakland, they were like pretty traditional Chinese people. And, like, they kicked me out. They were like, I was, like, bringing dudes home and smoking weed in my room and just stealing food and, like, all sorts of crazy stuff, you know. And they were just like, they could not deal. Like, I'm like, torn clothes and green hair and just, like, fuck you attitude, and, like, just didn't work, you know. And so they're like, you're out. And I just remember they were just like, and I didn't even realize it till later, they found, like, so much booze and drugs stashed all over my room, hidden in all these little corners or whatever. And I thought that was really normal. I'm like, that's what you're supposed to do. I mean, you're 15, right, or whatever, like, you're supposed to hide your drugs or whatever. But that's just how I was. Like, I just was always hiding in some corner, you know. So things got worse, and so here I'm at 16, kicked out. You know, I'm living with my mom, and she can't deal with me, so she kicks me out. And so I'm just, like, in the city, working in coffee shops, like, getting in trouble with lots of dudes who are much older than me, you know, like, living with hippies in the Mission, trying to, like, act like some big adult who has their shit together. And I'm like, well, I don't need all those guys or whatever. I can get my coffee shop job. I don't need anybody. And, like, I started using meth, and, like, things just was, like, my drug use and my addiction, like, it just got out of control, and I was kind of trying to attempt to, like, maintain and do these things and try to get some semblance of some sanity in my life, but every single attempt would just get worse and worse. And I remember I was living in this house in the Mission with this guy who's like probably in his 50s or 60s. He was, like, kind of, like, he dressed like he was, like, had gone to Vietnam, like, he had, like, the whole bandana and the fatigues, but he had never been to Vietnam. He had, like, a cerebral palsy and MS, and he just kind of walked around like this, and he just smoked weed all day and drank, like, multiple six-packs of beer, and would just, like, talk shit about the government, like, all day. And so he was just like, you can totally live here. It's totally cool. I'll be, like, your guardian or whatever. You can smoke as much bud as you want. You can drink as much as you want, but no white stuff. And as soon as he said the no white stuff, it was, like, off to the races. I was like, fuck you. Don't tell me what to do. And, you know, from there, I was dating this, like, fucking guy or whatever in the city, and he was like, he did raves and light shows, and did all his meth. And I just remember it just sent me to my knees, you know. Like, I'm like a bipolar person, right? And so you put anything in front of me, I'm a fucking, like, speed demon about whatever that is, and I use it until I fucking fall apart. And that's the way it was with me in meth. Like, it went down really fast, and I was like, waking up, not, like, it was like, would you say you shit your pants? Yeah, I shit my pants. And I was like, okay, that's it. You know, I'd have these, like, really horrendous experiences with drugs and alcohol, and I'd be like, shit my pants, or I'd be in the hospital, I'd have tube down my throat because I had alcohol poisoning, I'm never going to do that again. And then I'd be doing it again, like, the next day. Like, and it just didn't occur to me that that was addiction, you know? I thought that was just normal, or that was just being crazy, or that was just me and my story, and, like, I was just going down. But after I kind of had a kind of that bad bout with meth, I was like, okay, I'm quitting drugs. Like, that is it. I'm going to AA. I'm dragging my speed freak boyfriend with me, and we're going to get clean. And I just remember dragging him to this man, there was a gay men's meeting in the city. And he was like, okay, you know, and so we went and I thought it sounded pretty cool or whatever. And I got myself a sponsor actually. And we were kind of sitting at a coffee shop one day and we were talking about step work and stuff and about being powerless over alcohol and stuff. And I was like, well, my life's totally unmanageable, but like, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm an addict. I'm like a drug addict. I do drugs and I don't have a drinking problem. He's like, well, then go fucking drink. You know what I mean? And so I did, you know, and that's when I went and tried to control and enjoy my drinking like a lady. And it didn't work out. It did not work out at all. Like I was in here. I'm like not even 8. I'm like 17, 16. I'm 16 actually. And I was like trying to like drink like a lady, right? In the city. And like, I would go to like, different, like I was living in 19th and Guerrero, and I would go to all these different liquor stores in the neighborhood with like different accents. So, like one day I'd be like Irish, next day I'd be like Sicilian, and like it was just bizarre, right? And that's like a French accent or something like that, and like I would just rotate all these like these liquor stores and buy all this booze, and they were just like, I think they were just amused, you know, they were just like, okay, whatever. It was like I put on a good act, you know, and it was good enough for them, they're like, I hear whatever. But it just went downhill. It was just like whenever I controlled my drinking, I just didn't enjoy it. Whenever I enjoyed it, I couldn't control it. And just the amount of alcohol that it took to get me drunk was just starting to get like out of control. And my behavior, it was always, the first sponsor I had, I was always kind of like questioning, like, I don't know if I'm alcoholic because I didn't really like black out like you did or have these like crazy experiences. Like I remember most of what I did and it was like really embarrassing, everything I did. Like it was demoralizing and I couldn't stop myself from doing those things. But I don't know. Because sometimes it was okay. Sometimes I could just have one, but you know, most of the time it'd be like I couldn't. I just wake up the next day and like with some dude in my bed or whatever, and she'd be like, "You might be an alcoholic." But what ended up happening was there was all these. I had done all these trips. I tried to go to Canada and visit some family and do all these switching my type of alcohol. Like it was like I quit drinking hard alcohol because I would get like really sick, and so I would just like do wine and beer and all this kind of stuff, and it was just getting worse and worse and worse, and the feelings inside and that darkness that I was telling you about earlier was just overwhelming. And at this point I had tried to kill myself a bunch of times with like pills and alcohol and all those things, and I just couldn't seem to die. And at that point all I wanted to do was die, and I had no options. I had no friends, and about 6 months of trying to control my drinking and going to meetings and relapsing and all this kind of stuff, I was like dead inside, you know, like I'd gotten fired from all the coffee shop jobs. I was always getting fired, couldn't hold down a job, you know, couldn't go to school. My family did not want to have anything to do with me, and any friend that I had, I was like trying to get something out of them. Like either it was like money to pay my $200 rent bill that I couldn't pay or whatever it was, buy me cigarettes or something like that. And, that bleak moment that I had, that like kind of moment of clarity that, you know, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization moment, you know, they had had enough things that most people had been like, that's pretty bad. You might want to stop at that point. I was like, no, not yet. It was like, mine was just this bleak moment of just realizing like, you know, I've tried to kill myself, you know, like 20 times or whatever. And I can't seem to die. It just keeps getting worse. And this is just going to go on like this until forever. And it's just going to continue to get worse. And I'm not going to get to die. Type of thing. And it was just so awful. And I remember thinking, you know what, fuck it, I'll just go to AA again. See if that works, whatever. And if it doesn't work, maybe I'll try to jump off the Golden Gate. I haven't tried that yet. And but at this time, High Noon was a meeting that was literally a block from my house. I lived at 19th and Guerrero. It was at 19th and Dolores, in a literal block. So I just started going there every day and in earnest, you know, and I just raised my hand as like, that crazy newcomer that people were just like, oh my God. And I would raise my hand and be like, I'm Jenny, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm going to kill myself, fuck you all. And I'd run out the room and I keep coming back. And all this and I'd go back the next day and I'd be like, well, I didn't kill myself yesterday, but I do it today. You know, just like totally baiting people, just like a drama queen, total drama queen. And I'd be out like smoking 100 cigarettes afterwards. And a really kind woman named Leslie, was my first sponsor. She came out to me one of those days and I was all like, you all or whatever. And she's like, I'd like to be your sponsor. And I'm like, really? Really? You want to sponsor me? Like, good fucking luck, you know? And so that woman, she saved my life. And I did put her through hell. Like, my first month of sobriety was awful. Like, I wanted to use every day. I woke up every day just feeling terrified that I was alive and that I had to do this thing and I didn't know what to do and I didn't know how to talk to people or how to get a job or keep a job or anything. Nobody taught me any tools on how to like function on planet Earth, and I just felt so lonely and so just afraid, you know, and lost. And but slowly, you know, like through going to meetings and, you know, my sponsor, Leslie, we started working the book right away, you know, and even though that first month, like I ended up like cutting my arm open and going to the mental hospital and this whole thing, it was just kind of this like, I just need to stop, you know, I just need to like keep going to meetings and just like listen to what other people have to say and like quit thinking that I know what all the answers are and that you all don't know anything and that, you know, just fucking shut up. You know, and that's what I did. You know, I went to sometimes 2 to 3 meetings a day, you know, and I got everybody's phone number. And my sponsor said, you know, I want you to, you know, call people. And this is before cell phones, right? And she's like, I got sober when I was 17. That was 20 years ago. And at that point, there was no cell phones. It was like, we had pagers. That was about the highest tech back then. And so she would say, I want you to page so-and-so. Like, I want you to, like, call 5 people a day, you know, even... Because I was like, I can't call anybody. Like, what are they going to think, you know? Like, and she's like, you can call and hang up on them. It's okay. Like, but you just need to call to practice reaching out for help because you cannot do this by yourself. And that woman, you know, she kept telling me, you know what, I'm going to love you until you can love yourself, you know? And I was just like, that's just great. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. But she was right, you know? And she kept saying, you know, the solution has nothing to do with the problem. And, you know, if you want, you know, like, I didn't want to believe in God because God, my mother was a Catholic, and she would drag me to church with her, but she'd never baptize me or give me any information about what Catholic stuff was. I would just go in this church and just sit there and feel like not a part of something else. And, you know, I tried when I was in high school, like, all these various religions, like, that other people were around, like, Christianity and baptism, you know, Baptist church and Mormonism and Jehovah's Witness even, you know, like, all these things, like, trying to find some answer or reason for like why the world was so shitty and why it was the way it was and if there was anything that I could do to change it. And I didn't find any answers. So when I got here, I was just like, fuck God. You know, like I was so angry about the whole concept. Like I crossed out every reference to God in my first big book. I didn't want to hold hands with anybody or say the Serenity Prayer. Like I was like really belligerent. But she's like, you know, you can borrow my higher power, you know? And it was like the weird idea at the time, but I was like, okay, whatever. She was like, you know what? I want you to pray. And I was like, I don't want to fucking pray. She's like, but your way isn't working. You know, your way gets you high, drunk, and wanting to kill yourself. That does not sound manageable to me. And I was like, I got a point. So she's like, I just want you to pray. And so my first like bout of praying was just like laying on my bed and staring at the ceiling. And the ceiling for the longest time was my higher power because it was higher than me. And it was my heart. You know, I was like, that works, right? So I would just like talk to the ceiling and just be like, dear God, I guess if you exist, fuck you. And I guess just help me stay sober today. And that was like the best prayer that I could do. And it works, you know what I mean? And that was enough, you know, that was enough to get me going. And I would say my first like couple of years was, you know, a little rough. You know what I mean? But like things started to smooth out. Like I got a job, like a real job. My first job was I was a secretary at a mortgage brokerage firm downtown. Like I totally had to wear the outfit and I was like 17 making like 30 grand a year. And it's like, God bless them. You know what I mean? Like I was like on constant probation, like for one thing, like for fucking around with like the mailroom dude or being 10 minutes late every day or whatever. But like they kept me around and they didn't fire me, which is great. Right. And it taught me the value of showing up at a job every day and like, you know, just being a worker amongst workers, which had never been a concept to me, you know. You know, I grew up sober, you know, in this thing, you know. I remember hitting my 18th birthday being like, oh, man, wow, I'm an adult. I can actually legally buy cigarettes now. It's great. and, you know, I started going to young people's meetings. Like, it was a little difficult being, like, as young as I was in the city just because, you know, most people were at least in their 20s or, you know, 30s getting sober. And they would all, after the big social meetings, go out clubbing and dancing. And I'd be like, well, you know, I can't even go to a fucking, I can't do anything, you know. And so I'd be like, I guess I'll go home and play cards or something. But, you know, a lot of kind people, you know, reached out to me. And, you know, Jeff over there was one of them, you know. We'd go to a lot of different meetings, you know. We'd play cards. We'd hang out and play poker. And, young people seem is really great because I don't know if you guys have been, but like a lot of conferences all over the place and it's just big groups of people. But I didn't know that there could be other young people that would get sober that could have stories like mine, because a lot of people would come up to me and be like, you know, I spilled more than you drank, or, you know, some bullshit like that, right? And I'm like, you don't fucking know me, you know what I mean? Like if I had drank for, like, I can't even imagine having drank for, how I was going for 30 more years, you know what I mean? Like, I really don't know. I don't really think I would be here. And my life really got, really did change, you know, and after about that first couple of years, you know, I'd finished my first round of the steps, and I would say my first round of the steps is kind of cursory or whatever. I mean, I'm so young, I didn't have a whole lot of information in there, or little brains. But things like, I remember the first time I did the 11th step for myself, I was going to Ocean Beach in the city, and I would just sit at the beach and just stare at the ocean. And that was the maximum amount of meditation I could do at that time, which is that. And I just remember at that moment, there was this magical moment of just realizing I hadn't thought about drinking in a few months. And I hadn't thought about killing myself in a few months. And it was just like, you know what, maybe this thing is working. You know, like, because I had a lot of doubts about it. I was, like, very skeptical and, like, pretty much assuming that I was the only one it didn't work for. So I'll do it for a little while and I'll peace out or whatever. But it was working, you know. And I was, like, starting to feel that semblance of sanity in my life. And I would say, you know, it's been 20 years since, and that's a long time. And that's a lot of years for many different types of things to happen. And I would say, like, being in my 20s, being sober was really great, you know, because I got a lot of amazing opportunities to travel and work and do all these great things. Like, I got my GED, but I never got a degree or whatever, but I've been working in tech for, like, 20 years, you know, as this, like, software professional or whatever, and I always feel like I'm, like, a fraud and they're going to find out or whatever, but I've learned the value of just showing up at a job and being teachable and wanting to learn, and that goes farther than a lot of degrees ever will. You know, I feel like a lot of my 20s was like kind of figuring out identity. Like, I really struggled a lot with mental illness, and I mentioned that I was bipolar, and I was undiagnosed and unmedicated bipolar for a very long time. And I think I really struggled with that. I didn't want to take medications, and there's that stigma that we all have about taking meds and not wanting to take them. And there came a point when I was about maybe 8 or 9 years sober. You know, I'd had a lot of good things happening to me at this point. I decided to pursue some, like, dreams of mine. And one of them at that point was getting into being a professional horse trainer of all things or whatever. And so I volunteered to be this horse trainer slave up in Petaluma or whatever. And I was driving up there all the time, broke as hell, and doing all this stuff. And, like, slowly through the course of, like, going to lots of meetings and getting connected with people, I was able to get, like, these contract jobs, and I was making all this money, and I got a horse, and I made amends with my dad, and all these great things were happening. And then, like, suddenly, like, a bunch of tragic things happened, and my horse died, and my dad disowned me, and all this, like, crazy stuff. And I went plummeting into a really, really dark, dark depression, and I got to a place where I couldn't, like, talk to people. Like, I'd go to meetings, and people would just be like, sorry? Like, they didn't know what to say, and it just made me feel worse, you know, going to meetings and talking to people about it. And so I just isolated, and someone mentioned, like, I've been to a doctor, and I was like, I don't know, I don't want to take meds or whatever. And they're like, well, you might just want to see a doctor. And so I just, like, had the insurance book, and I just flipped all the pages and called, like, 10 of them, and I'm like, whoever called me back first, whatever, they're that, you know, they're going to be my doctor. And so guy called me back, and, like, I went into him, like, literally shaking. Like, I was such a mess, you know, and I feel like sometimes being sober just isn't enough, you know what I mean? Like, I needed more than just sobriety. I needed outside help, you know, I needed everything, you know. And so I went, and he was just like, you know what, let's just meet a few times, and then we'll see, or whatever. And then after the third time, he's like, you need meds or whatever. But and thank God for meds, you know. I've been on the same meds now for, like, 12 years or whatever, and I've been more or less pretty stable. It's a game changer for me. It was like I would rather be functional and, like, here than, like, this all the time, you know. And from there, like, things have been, it's been crazy, you know. I got to go live in India for about 4 years, and it was a really amazing experience to get to do that. And some ways I could call it kind of like a geographic, but in ways, other ways not. It was just, like, one of those amazing things where it was like, you can go, like, I'm the type of person that goes and visits a lot of places. Like, I travel a lot. Like, that's a part of my life now. I go a lot of places, and I'm always like, I want to move here now. And that was one of the places that I, like, moved to. And they didn't have a lot of meetings there. You know, they had one English meeting a day, and it was all Indian dudes. And they, like, did not regard me very well. Like, is this, like, foreigner young girl, you know what I mean, who wanted to tell them how to work the program. But they were doing all wrong. You know, like, they were literally, so there'd be, like, a bunch of dudes sitting in a schoolroom or whatever, and there'd be one dude up here just, like, telling it how it is or whatever. And they weren't reading it out of the big book or anything. And it was just kind of like, this isn't it. Or whatever, and I went in there and be like, well, you need to read the book. And talk about loneliness, right? And, like, after that, like, I pretty much felt really isolated. And I got to a place in India where, like, I wanted to drink again, you know? Like, I was so miserable. And it's, like, the one thing that, like, I know for alcoholics is, like, we just struggle with our brains and our minds and our thoughts. And it's just all the self-centeredness just combines, and it's just like, I'm a shitty person and nobody loves me and I shouldn't be here, like all this stuff, you know, that comes up. And I want to drink, you know, like, that's my only solution, that's, like, my only way to cope with life is to get high. But it doesn't work, it ends up fucking you in the end, right? It makes it worse, and then you're in this, like, vicious cycle. And, like, I knew that, you know, but at the same time, it's like, what else am I gonna do, you know? And so I remember I was miserable. I wanted to drink. And I remember calling back to one of these meetings and, like, just totally tail between my legs, just being like, you know what, guys, I'm an alcoholic just like you are. I have the same brain that wants to drink and wants to, like, just basically self-implode. And, you know, I don't want to drink, and that's why I'm here, and I need your help, you know? And that was it, you know? And it was like when I finally let go of my way and what I thought and how things should be was when things really changed for me. And those guys in India saved my life, you know, they really did. And it was when I let go and just let them take care of me, you know, and let the way that the program does when we do let go, you know, and stop thinking that we know everything and just try something different. Like, just give it a fucking shot, you know, like, what's really the worst thing that could happen? It doesn't work and I'll go to a drink, right? Whatever, fucking get a refund, right? You know, that was it, you know. And to this day, I feel like I have family in India. You know, I ended up starting a women's meeting, and it was really brutal because, like, there were no other women, right? I was, like, the only woman there. And so I remember sitting in this room, this coffee shop, and for, like, an hour. I would do that for months on end, waiting for somebody to show up, and nobody came, right? And so it was just, like, really depressing. But slowly, over time, the fellowship that they talk about it in the book, like, the fellowship that you crave, they know will come, you know? And that's what happened for me. And it was a really amazing experience, and I feel like the women that I know from there are still running those meetings, you know, and we never really know, I think, who we touch, you know, when we get sober anywhere in life, right? We might be sober or not sober, but who we talk to, who we meet in these different places, and the impact that we can have on anything, right? So anyway, I've been back for a good long while, and I can say, you know, like, 20 years sober, it's like, it's weird, you know, it's fucking weird. And about 6 months ago, I broke up with, I had a long-term relationship that ended, and it just, like, for me, like, relationship, it's just like, I sent me crashing to my knees, you know what I mean? It just brought up all of my, it's like, I think, you know, I've been doing a lot of, like, you know, codependency or child work or whatever, and I feel like that's just, like, the next frontier sometimes when you're, you know, in sobriety or recovery or whatever. But it just brought up all the griefs of all the griefs and all the abandonments of all the abandonments. And it was just like this, like, giant, like, sadness ball that was, like, trying to crush me. And I wanted to kill myself, you know what I mean? Like, it was just awful and I didn't know how to cope. And it gave me the opportunity to really look deep inside, you know? And the one thing I can say now that I'm so grateful for about being sober and having done the work and having gone to meetings and worked on, done, like, I wake up, like, my morning routine every day is I wake up, I write for half an hour and meditate. Like, I've been doing that for, like, 15 years every day, no matter how shitty I feel. And I think it's given me a certain kind of foundation so that when that shit happened, you know, yeah, inside I was like, I want to go jump off a bridge, but, like, I didn't do anything. I wasn't cutting my arms open, sleeping with 10 dudes or smoking 5 packs of cigarettes. Like, I was just sitting there, miserable, and just sitting there. And it was just like, I remember, like, so after the breakup had happened, I went to, I had a sabbatical at work, and I went to Africa to go learn how to kite surf. Like, fucking amazing, right? But I'm in this, like, amazing, beautiful country wanting to, like, just end it because I'm just so stuck in my head. And it was amazing because what happened was I was, like, sitting there feeling like I can't talk to anybody, I don't know what to do, and I'm just miserable. And it was just like, just do the next right thing. Go brush your teeth. And it's like, I know you want to kill yourself right now, but it's okay. Let's go eat breakfast. It'll be all right. And it was just like through the, like, being sober and doing all this stuff, it was like I can learn how to like just sit there and like make space for all the things that come up for me, whether it be sadness, joy, rage, terror. It's like I can be sober in the face of it. Like I don't have to jump off a bridge. I don't have to smoke 100 cigarettes. Like I can just be here. And that's the gift of recovery. And then it passes, you know, and then the next thing happens. And like, I just got back from Japan a week ago and I had the most amazing time. Like I went there for a vacation and learned, like I also teach cooking on the side. That's like another dream of mine. Like fucking teach people how to cook Indian food. Like I'm a Chinese Canadian girl. Whatever. Right. It's great. It's super fun. And, I feel like being sober and like doing this stuff, I mean, I feel like my life is amazing. Like I live the life beyond my wildest dreams. Like from that person that was like that shriveling, like couldn't function person, like, you know, I'm free, you know, and that's the most amazing thing. I'm free. I'm free from the terror, the obsession, the addiction, the chaos, the insanity. And if I do this every day, you know, it's like, that's a thing. It's like, I have alcoholism. I have addiction. I have this disease that tells me that I don't have a disease and that I should just drink. I'm not really an alcoholic. And well, it's been 20 years, like all that stuff, right? And it's like, I do, you know, it's like my disease is doing fucking push-ups in the back of my head, just waiting for me that one little like light moment where I'm not paying attention to like get high, right? And like, I've seen a lot of friends get high and kill themselves and go out and they don't come back. And I don't want that for myself. As bad as it can get sometimes emotionally, like it can get far worse, you know? And I love my life today. I really love my life. And for anybody that's new, man, like just keep coming back. And as trite as those words sounded to me when I first came here, they made a big difference because it's a thing. No matter how you feel, like get your ass to a meeting, save your ass before your face, you know? And that was something that has saved my ass many times, just that phrase alone. Get a sponsor, work with steps, get phone numbers and fucking call them, even though that phone feels like 1,000 pounds. And the thing is like, I didn't know it. Like, I feel it because I sponsor a lot of women today. It's like when they call me and I get to help them, it's like the most magical feeling to get to pass this on. Like, I never really thought that I would have anything for anybody, that they would want anything from me. You know what I mean? I felt like such a broken person. But the coolest thing today is that I get to pass it on, and then they pass it on, and they continue to pass it on, and it's not about me, you know? And that's the thing. It's like, AA is kind of like this, like, little, like, get out of me fucking medicine ball, you know? And I'm really grateful for that. And really grateful for all the friends and the people and the women and the people in these rooms that have saved my life. And I still got like 5 more minutes. Jesus Christ. I guess I can stop, huh? All right. That's good. I probably will. I guess parting words is just to say that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the steps. I love this program. I love you guys. And without any of you guys, I wouldn't be here today. And if I hope my story helps anybody in here, and if it didn't, go to another meeting. And it gets better. It gets a lot better. So thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.